Hello, everybody. My name is Irene, and I'm so grateful to be here to share my experience, strength, and hope, not as a recovering alcoholic, but as someone who is grateful for the fellowship and all of you who have influenced my life tremendously. Hi. I wondered if I'd get that. Thank you. Make me feel welcome. My life story, my experience, strength, and hope is I'm not good enough. That's what I always feel about myself. Now, how many of you can honestly raise your hand and say you know where Grand Prairie, Alberta, Canada is? Oh, right on. We're a large Albertan community of about 55,000. That's large for Alberta. We are about 10-hour drive north of the U.S. border. If you were to fly between Edmonton and Grand Prairie, you would see bush, 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 and more bush until you got to our city. There's a, if you drive at night, you see these odd little flames. Those of you from Texas will know what those are. They're oil wells, natural gas wells. And you drive up there and you swear that you are going to the edge of the earth. There's one place near where I live called Tangent. And I drove there and it's so flat that you swear the world will end there soon, that you're going to drop off. And so but just south of us, we have the beauty of the Canadian Rockies. And I'm very blessed that from my front window, I can look unto the hills from whence cometh my strength and see the beautiful Rocky Mountains to the south. So that's a little bit about where I live. My job is as a manager of an addiction and mental health facility. We have a 20-bed detox facility, and we have 43 treatment beds, and we have a day treatment mental health program. So not good enough. I thought that when I read this little thing, my friend Connie here told me, you've got two doctors that you're speaking with, you know, and so I thought, I'm not good enough for this. But God has a purpose and plan for my life, and so I get to be blessed to be here today. A lot of miracles have happened in my life that caused me to be here. When I grew up in an alcoholic home, my father was an alcoholic, and I didn't understand what was happening. At about age 11, I started attending a church just because a family friend invited me and my four sisters to go. Lo and behold, the pastor of that church, Pastor Duane, was in recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. What a wonderful blessing in my life. He understood what my home was like and what I was going through. When I was 14 years old, we had a little session in the church, and he said to me, "Irene, I think you should go into rehab." Well, he didn't mean I needed treatment. He meant that as a career, I should go into rehab. And so, to me, though, rehab was for physically disabled people where they go in and you do things like Goodwill does. And so I thought, well, that's not for me. I don't want to go and teach physically disabled people how to rebuild refrigerators. And so I kind of looked the other way, and I went and studied cross-cultural missions instead. And as part of that degree, I went up to Canada for a summer to work among First Nations peoples. And lo and behold, I met my future husband, a First Nations person. I had a deep fascination with Aboriginal culture and First Nations. And so it wasn't surprising that that I was led there by another miracle. I quickly got a job with Child Welfare Services and spent ten years in that, about $10 was all I was paid too. Spent 10 years in that profession, but not knowing that at the heart of a lot of these families' problems was alcoholism and other addictions. And I can remember I went to one home where the family was very rural. And the mother was a single mother of three small children, and she had no transportation. And her problem was alcoholism. And I said to myself, well, how am I going to help this person? She doesn't want to go to treatment because she's got these small children and she doesn't want them in foster care system. So I thought back to my pastor and I said, maybe I'll go look up the big book. And so I pulled out the big book and together we sat and read the big book, and as best I could, not knowing what I was doing, I said, let's look at these 12 steps and let's try to help you. That woman is still in recovery today. She started going to meetings shortly after. Well, I started looking at my own life about that time as well. I showed up at work one day with a black eye because my alcoholic husband had hit me. A member of Al-Anon who worked in the same building as I came up to me and said, Irene, I think I have someplace you need to go. So it was there I learned the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and actually saw what I was doing wrong with that person. Because AA work should remain ever non-professional. I didn't know that at that time. It was 10 years into that profession as child welfare and about 6 years into my recovery in Al-Anon that they opened the Northern Addiction Center, or were scheduled to open the Northern Addiction Center in our city. And the then director of that center came to me and said, Irene, I want you to come work for us. And I said, I'm not worthy. My husband's still drinking. I'm not good enough to be working in a treatment center. And she said to me, exactly. I learned that there's merit in humility. People see it and they enjoy it. There's merit in you sharing your experience, strength, and hope, no matter where you're at, no matter what your situation is. And I was amazed. Many years later, my pastor's prophecy actually came true. I was working in rehab. God has plans for us that we don't even know, wonderful plans. And no matter where we come from or where we've been, He will guide us. I've learned that. So I was appointed, when I first started, I started as a supervisor, and I was appointed as the AA liaison, probably because I was the only one that knew much about it at that time. And my then director, who is now a trustee on the AA board, had faith in me as well. And so I was appointed into that role, and thank God for the people of AA. They taught me how to really effectively be an influencer in the lives of recovering Alcoholics and Addicts. Some of the best advice I got from them, some of the best instruction. Now, I was talking with some people at lunch today, and they were asking questions like, how good is your literature delivery there? Well, ours is excellent. Any of you who are serving on institutions committees, support your institutions. It means the world to them. Show up for the institutions meetings. Support the newly recovering alcoholics. It means the world to us. All I have to do if I'm running short on literature is pick up the phone. They bring it to me. All I have to do is pick up the phone if I need someone to come speak. They're there. In one of our programs, we just celebrated our 20th anniversary, and the recovering alcoholics there made the program, them sharing their experience, strength, and hope. We invited all of our current residents, and that's what impacted them, not hearing about our programs and our services, but hearing the stories of those of you who are in recovery. I want to talk about a little bit about AA in rural communities. Like I said, we're kind of a rural area. Every little community that's in northern Alberta is in desperate need of help. So imagine that you come from a small rural community. Some of you may. What's the only game in town if you want to get sober? It's AA. We've seen AA members drive 50, 75 kilometers to go pick up another member and take them to meetings, because that otherwise they wouldn't get there. Distances are hardly anything in Alberta. There might be an understanding pastor in a local community, but for the most part, the only people that understand AA are you all. Understand alcoholism, are there to support. So we truly rely on you. I'm also grateful that you embrace diversity. A lot of our members are dual addicts. They're alcoholics and other drugs, and they are welcome in most of our meetings if they talk about their alcoholism. And for that, I'm grateful, because like I said, if it wasn't for AA, there'd be no support at all. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the importance of online meetings. I was sitting next to a member on the plane over here, not sure if he's here, tried to see if he was here. And he said, he was talking about online meetings, and he made me remember that we have a large population that works in the oil patch, and they work either 10 or 14 days in the bush and 10 or 14 days out of the bush. And so when they're in the bush, they're bushed. and but they have their iPhone. And they're so grateful to hear that even there with an iPhone, they can have a meeting. That's their only line of hope for many of them. You know, they're supposed to be dry camps. They're supposed to be dry workplaces up there, but they're not. Booze is all over the place. But when they can pull up that app and go to a meeting, they can have another day sober. I also wanted to talk about the blessing of being a non-member, in that we can use promotion, not attraction. People who come in for help into our center, we get the privilege of saying, thou shalt go to 3 meetings a week. Or else, you're not going to stay here long. And so somebody at lunch today said that 85% of people in AA got there some other way, through another profession. And So for that, I'm grateful that actually we have a program that works that we can refer to. You are our follow-up care. We use Bridging the Gap quite a lot. I appreciate that somebody's there waiting for our folks when they get to their home communities, waiting to take them to meetings. Yes. I'd like many of you to consider, if you want to help with Bridging the Gap on the other end and greet the recovering alcoholic as they return home. Personally, I still use the program principles, especially the slogans, in my work. I don't know some days what I would do if I didn't remind myself to live one day at a time. Our organization is a part of a government organization. The political pressures, the funding cuts, price, you can understand that the price of oil severely affects our funding. And it's plummeted recently. And so if I can say one day at a time, I can get through that day, and I can know that it'll be okay tomorrow. I also say this too shall pass, because it will. So the slogans enrich my life, and I'm grateful for them. I want to talk a little bit about mental health and alcoholism. I used to only work in addictions, and then we merged with mental health services and became addiction and mental health services, and they gave me a whole mental health program. But I had had a mental health program for about 10 years before that, because my oldest son suffers from schizoaffective disorder. And he also is an addict. And so the two things often go hand in hand. The dual diagnosis, as we call it, both carrying mental health issues and alcoholism. And so I'm grateful that yours is a program of inclusion. Where else can you go and the rest of the world says you're not good enough, you're not worthy, but AA says welcome. You're welcome here. You have an alcohol problem? I don't care if you have a mental health problem. You're welcome here. And, you know, a lot of the people that I work with mental health issues, they can't find anywhere else where they get that kind of inclusion. So I want to thank you for that type of inclusion. You're making a difference in those people's lives. You're giving them hope. Hope more than they can get off the alcohol, but hope that they can have a community, a fellowship, where they too belong. And I want to thank you for that. How am I doing for time? 5 minutes, okay. Well, they told us initially 20 minutes, so now I don't have anything else to say. I just want to say I'm grateful. Like I said, when I got the call to come speak here, I thought, I'm not worthy enough. I've received nothing but warmth and inclusion and smiles. And I want to thank each and every one of you for that. And that's a blessing to me. You've enriched my life in many ways. I hope through my story you've seen it's just not a one-time thing. You made a difference. You made a difference in this healthcare professional's life. And I'm grateful to be able to come here and thank you. Keep it up. You do great work. Thank you.
All right, I'm putting on my timer. I'm Brian Johnson, and I am so grateful to be here. I don't know if this is going to help you to hear me speak, but it's going to help me to give this talk. I'm a neuropsychoanalyst, and what that means is going to become clear, but the motive for my doing all the work in addiction that I do is I grew up in an addicted family. Everyone else had addiction. My father died of his alcoholism when I was 18, and it was such a jolt that I wanted to do something about it. So what I'm going to do eventually is talk to you about my understanding of some of the AA slogans and what they mean from the neuropsychoanalytic perspective. Now, that sounds funny, but let me bring it this way. We have a service which trains about a third of the medical students at SUNY Upstate. They do their 5-week psychiatry clerkship on addiction medicine. They are all required to go to Alcoholics Anonymous the first chance they get. And I've always taken my psychiatry residence to Alcoholics Anonymous, which means I've been to about 300 meetings so far. When I teach the medical students how to do psychoanalytic interpretation, I start with this Central New York story. So it's too big a meeting for me to get individual answers, but see if you can answer these questions, because this is the basis of the analytic approach. What do you call a deer with no eyes? No idea. Good. Some people got it. All right. What do you call a deer with no eyes and no legs? Still no idea. Someone's maybe either a genius or has heard this before. All right, you might even be a hunter. So what do you call a deer with no eyes, no legs, and no penis? Not hearing the answer. Still no fucking idea. So in other words, the medical students or residents are asked to follow the patient's direction. It's the polar opposite of the cognitive behavioral psychotherapy approach where you teach drug addicts lessons about recovery. I tell all the students, you don't know a thing about addiction. Your job is to be stupider than your patient. Let them lead and just make some comments about what they're saying. Okay, so that's the orientation melded with some of the brain science I'll mention in a few minutes. I use this idea from AA when people want to come to Upstate for addiction treatment. No one is allowed to come in alone. If you arrive alone, you're told to come back another time with a sober support person. We have terrific outcomes on our service, and one way we cheat to get good outcomes is we require anyone who wants to come for treatment to reach out and ask for help before they walk in the door. And my administrator, Jackie, constantly gets calls like, oh, gee, there's no one who can come with me. No one cares about me anymore. And Jackie says, well, here's the list of places you can go by yourself. And invariably, 5 minutes later, they call up and say something like, oh, my mother can come with me. The support person listens to the entire intake, which is both a psychiatric and medical and addiction assessment, And all our detox is done outpatient. We now have the technology that there's no reason ever or hardly ever to admit someone to the hospital. We can bring your alcohol withdrawal under control in about 3 hours. Opioid detox is a snap. So the person is looking at us while we do their detox. It's not like you go to a hospital and then you're told to go to some other service after discharge. When that's done, the most common next contact is the next detox. The rule for treating comorbid disorder. So I was talking at lunch today about why don't more people go to AA? So my really dumb medical students all asked the patient something like, most people with good recovery go to Alcoholics Anonymous, why wouldn't you? They don't know. They don't know the answer to that question. They're dumber than the patient. But we do find that there's a fair amount of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, severe comorbid depression, borderline personality disorder. So the goal of our outpatient treatment, which is relatively brief, is to get people into a process of recovery. So if we treat their ADHD, they're more likely to go to AA meetings and get what's going on, not just think, who is that guy with the funny glasses who was up there talking? How do we treat ADHD without giving addicting stimulants? We don't give benzodiazepines. There are perfectly good alternatives. For example, bupropion is a stimulating antidepressant that treats ADHD great. So a lot of our patients go to AA, we'll give the standard mantra, 90 meetings in 90 days, join a group, get a sponsor. And constantly a focus of the treatment is, if you're not going to AA, what's your thinking about it? Okay, we use a concept, and if you ever want to see any of our resources, all our detox protocols, all the academic papers, a book I wrote for teenagers is at our website, which is drugzombie.com. Okay, we use a concept called dual aspect monism, which means simply people intuitively get a lot of what's going on in the brain. So you can look at it by fMRI or other imaging studies or studies of brain chemistry, or you can sit there and empathically intuit what's going on. So what I'm going to do is go back and forth here and talk about some of the AA slogans and what my understanding is from the either psychoanalytic or brain science viewpoint. So the first one is, we drink because we're alcoholics. Isn't that like a stupid idea? But the answer is no. It's a profound insight about how the brain works. There are certain things that all animals or humans want. Food, water, sex, relationships. There's a drive system built in. It's the ventral tegmental to nucleus accumbens dopaminergic pathway, but you don't have to remember that. It's close to the breathing center. We all want to eat. We all want to breathe. Many of us want to have sex. And if you get addicted, it means that the drug has gotten inserted into this pathway. So you urgently want to drink, even though horrible things are happening to you. You just want to drink the same way you just want to breathe. So this is not a stupid, trite saying. This is a profound statement. Or we're powerless over alcohol. Once your brain is changed so that it urgently is seeking alcohol, you've lost your will. So this is the will pathway. You can read it in the zombie book that's at my website. It's in a paper in the Frontiers in Human Neuroscience 2013, but you lose your will. Alcohol controls you. So this is why the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you're willing to have a power greater than yourself to restore you to sanity, makes perfect neuroscience sense. You've lost your will. If you don't turn it over to God as you know Him, you're just going to drink. It's the nature of the brain. So people in AA have intuited this over the years. There's another slogan that fits in the same way. You can't change a pickle back into a cucumber. You just can't. I'm sorry, it's awful, but once this change has occurred in your brain, you have alcoholism and you can't get it out. It's in your brain forever. That's the nature of the disease. The only thing you can do is stay sober one day at a time. And one more along this line is let go or be dragged. Okay. Here's a second concept from neuroscience that is embedded in AA intuitively through empathically tuning into what's going on inside yourself and others. If you have this hideous, insistent, urgent, endless wish to drink despite the consequences, you need frontal inhibition. And the frontal lobe is the place where your sense of time lies. So it's always thinking about the past, the future, the present. And with the wisdom of millions of people, the slogan is one day at a time. It means freeze your frontal function so that it stays focused on inhibiting that urge to drink just today. The frontal cortex is weak compared to the drive system. So this slogan consolidates the focus on keep your eye on the ball and just think about the present. Another slogan that is the same neural system concept is it's alcoholism, not alcoholism. So you have to stay in the present or you can't keep inhibiting the urge to drink, which unfortunately it dies down, but it probably never disappears. Okay, now I'm going to switch from brain science to the concept of narcissism. So narcissism for psychoanalysts is a set of internal fantasies. And you stop relating to other people and you start to relate to the fantasies and you actually become unrelated. In order to recover, you have to urgently depend on the people around you, the people in recovery. If you have a narcissistic stance, it leads to relapse. So one AA slogan that addresses the narcissism that opposes recovery is the idea of the egomaniac with an inferiority complex. That's what narcissism is. Or I love this one, no one is too stupid to get this program, but some people are too smart. Living life on life's terms. So when you're drinking, you're filled with fantasies that this is the greatest thing ever. One of my patients said to me, Doc, I drank a case of beer. My friend drank a case of beer. We both had sex with the same woman. We both got herpes that night. You could never do anything like that. That's the fantasy that drinking is the most astounding thing ever. Who could ever drink a quart of vodka, a case of beer? Is that that's the narcissism of the disease, which is opposed by the idea that once you get sober, you lead an ordinary life. You can't save your face and your ass at the same time. Same idea. Humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. Humility is about being right-sized. So all these are opposing the narcissism of active addiction. All right. You ready for paranoia? All right. So it's a kind of nasty-sounding term. Here, I'm just looking at my time. Great. But what it means is you're just finding aspects of yourself in other people. So it's like not that I want to show off in front of all of you. It's, gee, I'm so worried about how you're evaluating my talk. So you take something that's going on with you. In this case, I am a show off and I have to admit it and maybe even enjoy it. And it's projecting it out into somebody else, which is summarized by slogans such as, don't take other people's inventories. So you're familiar with, especially in early recovery, people walk into an AA meeting and they notice what yucky people there are at the meetings. And, you know, it's awful and it sounds silly to say it here, but it happens all the time. And it's opposed by don't take other people's inventories. Keep your side of the street clean. So these become psychoanalytic interpretations when we're working with patients who are just through detox, just trying to catch on to recovery, and what do they want to talk about? Oh my God, you wouldn't believe this woman I'm married to, this man I'm married to. You know, I'm sure, doctor, you're thinking I should get a divorce this minute. Well, of course, we're not thinking that. We're thinking, talk about yourself, not somebody else. You know, if you think your husband is a total idiot, bring us $5,000. We'll do an evaluation, and we'll send you a report. You're only as sick as your secrets. Now, this one is deviously clever. Why do people need to keep secrets, right? The whole concept of getting into recovery is you come, and you may not want to do it in a meeting, but at least with your sponsor, you pour your heart out. You do the step 4 and 5 inventory. Whatever is like the worst thing ever about you, that's exactly what you have to talk about during step 5. So secrets are about shame. Secrets are about embarrassment. Secrets are things that you think other people shouldn't be learning about. Another concept that's related is the reservation. It's the reservation that drives you back to drinking. And here's another terrific one in the paranoia section. What other people say behind my back is none of my business. So you're obviously not worried about what's going on with other people because it's actually the paranoia of active addiction. All right. Next defense that is a very common part of continuing addictive behaviors, avoidance, which is kind of obvious, but do the next right thing would be an example of not avoiding. Courage is action through fear, so the urge to avoid is replaced by tolerating your fear and doing whatever you need to do. Move a muscle, change a feeling. And when you don't feel like going to a meeting, you should go to a meeting. So what that's about is you're noticing something is making you anxious, you've got some issues, and if you go to AA, chances are it's going to come up one way or another, that magic way that God's looking down on us all and makes exactly what we needed to hear come up at that night's meeting. If you use avoidance and you don't go to the meeting, you get sicker And if you go to the meeting, even though you don't feel like going, of course everyone reports they feel so great when they leave. Okay. I'm going to talk about one more psychoanalytic concept that is shared in Alcoholics Anonymous. This may be obvious to people, too. I learned it by reading a Bill W. pamphlet about his 1956 speech to Alcoholics Anonymous. When they were forming AA in Akron, they had these miraculous people who showed up, and one of them, R, I think his name was, had been in psychoanalysis with Jung in Zurich. He came to AA because he couldn't stay sober, and after talking to everybody, he realized that he needed to go back and ask Jung, like, psychoanalysis is a magic treatment, how come I'm not cured? And Jung's reply, as Bill W. told it in that pamphlet or speech, was, Jung said, you need a spiritual awakening. So the analytic concept of the ego ideal and the AA concept of a spiritual recovery are actually identical. Fear is a lack of faith. Fear is a lack of faith. This is another incredibly profound one. What you have to do to recover, that step 1, 2, 3 medley that everyone needs to start with, that's about making a leap of faith that there will be good people there to help you. So many of you grew up in homes like me or lots of our patients. You grow up with barbaric people. You're drinking in response to that, which of course is a reproduction of the abuse. And you have to go and make that leap of faith that the people you see in the halls or rooms of AA are really going to help you. So fear is a lack of faith. Drinking is a solitary activity. Recovery is an intensely social experience. A related concept which we use all the time with our patients is, you are too valuable to drink yourself to death. We need you. We need you. And you say this to people all the time. They walk into their first meeting. They look horrible because they're terribly ill. They come to our service. They're going through withdrawal, which is an awful process. And we tell them, we need you so much to share your recovery, strength, and hope with everyone as a spiritual activity. So it's the analytic concept of the ego ideal, and it's the step 11, 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Addictions replace relationships. Same kind of thing. So if I had to summarize then, it's an amazing thing that the millions of people who have come through Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 80 years have all talked to each other and talked to each other, and the amount of effort is like the stars in the sky, and these AA aphorisms have been distilled down as the wisdom of what goes on with alcoholism and how to recover. 21st century brain science is understanding finally what you guys have known all along. It really is a brain disease. It really is stuck in you forever. People do that famous experiment where they've been sober, now I haven't had a drink in 2 years, 10 years. I can go out and maybe I'm cured, and then they come back. And they report the results of the experiment to the next meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because once it gets into you, it's no one's fault that you have alcoholism, but it's your responsibility to do something about it. You can't get it out of you, and yet once your disease is in remission, if you look around, everyone looks at least semi-normal here. Okay, so that's what we do on our service. And I am so grateful for your giving me a chance to maybe have an exchange, because I'm sure I'll talk to people after this, about refining these ideas even more. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Warren. I feel comfortable, thank you. So our topic and the whole panel is AA and the healthcare professional, and my understanding of a lot of these talks is it's about how the AA and recovering person relates to the healthcare professional, the HP. We'll talk about that in a second. My talk is going to be, my talk is going to be actually kind of the opposite. How does the healthcare professional function as a recovering person? What troubles do they have becoming a recovering person? I'll talk about my drugs of choice in a minute, but one of the things I do is I give a lot of talks with PowerPoint to medical audiences, and I always like to say I have no financial or other conflicts of interest. I always follow that up by saying that I have a lot of biases, and if I do a good job here this afternoon, you'll learn some of those. I will say, I'm not going to really tell my own story here, but I will say that one of my biases, or many of my biases, come from having learned a lot about addiction growing up. I'll just kind of leave it at that for now. So as I said, I'm really going to talk about the healthcare professional and how we relate to AA and recovery and not the other way around. I'll talk about my job, but in particular, when I talk about healthcare professional, I'm going to refer mainly to doctors and PAs. In North Carolina, in my job, we work with physicians and PAs, veterinarians and vet techs. So I'm going to talk about physician and a little bit more generally about professional health, and then specifically about physician health programs. So I'll start with a story many of you have heard. An AA member passes on and reaches his reward, and he goes to heaven and he finds all sorts of wonderful things. He meets a lot of friends and family that have passed on ahead of him. He's wandering around, and he gets hungry, and he goes to the heaven cafeteria, and to his chagrin, he finds there's a long, long line in the heaven cafeteria, which is kind of puzzling. You wouldn't think that would be the case. So he's standing in line, like, you know, following good orderly direction like he's learned in life, standing in line like he should. And while he's waiting, this guy in a white coat, stethoscope, and a beard rushes past the whole line, goes to the front, and grabs a tray and grabs his food. And the guy, the newbie in heaven, says, turns to the man behind him and says, who's that guy I think he is? And the man behind him says, oh, him, that's God. He thinks he's a doctor. So I don't know how many healthcare professionals or doctors there are in the audience. I've probably just insulted you intentionally or unintentionally. But like most jokes, there's a little bit of truth in every joke. I mean, there's a reason that it's funny. Dr. Johnson talked about, you know, egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. A lot of us have heard that phrase. Some of us have lived it. Well, doctors, you know, to a certain extent, societally and in our own medical culture, being an egomaniac is kind of written into the job description a little bit. My training director in psychiatry said, you know, when I want a surgeon, I don't want somebody who's insecure and unsure of himself. I want somebody who's real secure holding that scalpel. You know, you're supposed to be a little bit of an egomaniac. It kind of goes with the job. So as I said, I've picked up a few drugs of choice along the way. My drugs of choice to date are caffeine, PowerPoint, and work, not necessarily in that order. You'll see the strength of my PowerPoint addiction. I couldn't get through the lecture without having this transitional object. I do have some professional and even personal passing familiarity with the steps. I know a little bit about, I think it's the fourth or fifth step, a searchless and fearing moral inventory, something about that. I'm not sure how you'd work that. My friend Mick, though, told me about one that seems a lot easier to work. He talked about making a list of all those who had harmed me and asking God to remove them. I think that's a step I could more easily work. So my professional background, before I got into the physician health program work, and I'll talk about that in a minute, I worked at a mental health center and a treatment center, which unfortunately is now closed, and a large hospital running a psychiatric consult service. And a lot of what we did on the psychiatric consult service related around addiction. At least 20 and probably upwards of 30-35% of people on your average medical surgical ward are addicted or alcoholic, and that directly relates to the reason they're there. I remember in particular a couple cases. One, I encountered a gentleman who had had a bad encounter with a train, and he was in literally one of these full body casts that you see on TV. And I was asking him, and he was sleeping near the tracks. He wasn't sleeping on the tracks, or I probably wouldn't have been talking to him. But it was related to alcohol. He had passed out near the tracks. And I asked him, you know, you ever thought about getting any help, going to any of those meetings and those rooms? And he said, oh, Doc, yeah, I've been to those AAA meetings. You know, I just, they really weren't for me. And I don't know, maybe he had some cognitive impairment, but I think he probably wasn't ready. The other thing I remember, though, in speaking to how much healthcare professionals do or don't know about addiction, is I encountered another person on the ward who had a blood alcohol around 0.40. And those of you who are familiar with blood alcohol levels, I think there may be one or two in the room. Drinking and driving levels 0.08 in most states. This guy was five times the legal level plus, and he walked under his own power into the emergency room. And the nurse, so he was, I don't even remember what he was on the ward for, but what I do remember is the nurse came up to me and said, you know, you've written alcohol dependence in the chart. Is he really that bad? I mean, is he really that much of a problem? And I thought, you know, you've been all the way through nursing school and you're working on a med-surg unit, you really don't get it. And unfortunately, that's not an uncommon thing. So my day job these days, I've worked at the North Carolina Physician's Health Program for the last 16 years. And that's really a powerful, powerful thing for me to experience personally. And to get to help other physicians and PAs and now veterinarians and vet techs. I'll talk a little bit generally about physicians' health programs. They exist in most states. The basic philosophy of a physician health program is to get the doctor or professional into treatment as early as possible, thereby helping the doctor or PA or whoever themselves and also protecting the public. If you can wait before, you know, if you can get the person in to help before the wheels come all the way off the cart, or ideally it's just they're a little wobbly, everybody's going to be better off, including the doctor, including the patients that they treat. Most PHPs, including our own in North Carolina, and you have an excellent new physician health program, relatively new over the last several years here in Georgia, most PHPs do not provide direct treatment. We never take off the treatment hat. I never take off my psychiatrist hat. My wife says I'm pretty normal for a psychiatrist. I think she means that as a compliment. But we don't actually provide direct treatment to the doctor. What we do provide is assessment. We do basically in North Carolina, we do a screening assessment in-house, and very often that's a presenting question of alcohol. We want to rule that in or rule it out. We also want to look for other things. We want to look for co-occurring disorders because you can treat the alcohol or drug addiction, but if you don't look at the sex addiction, if you don't look at the gambling or other process addiction, you're really going to miss the boat, and the person, be that a civilian or a physician or whoever, is not going to stay in recovery typically. We refer out to treatment, and you also have some excellent, excellent treatment centers here in Georgia that have historically treated a lot of professionals. Doug Talbot was sort of the founder of the physicians' health movement, and he's right here out of Atlanta. We do monitoring, and typically in physician health programs, that's urine drug screens. And typically we do ask people to go to meetings, and I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. Based on all the above, then, we're in a position to advocate for the doctor, quote-unquote. And that can be, it used to be if you had a medical license as a physician, you were pretty much good to go. Now the medical license is kind of the starting point. You need the license, you need your hospital credentials, you need your subspecialty boards, you need to be in good standing with the DEA, you need to be credentialed by Medicare and Medicaid. So it's a lot more complicated than it used to be, and the game is really complicated for the physicians and therefore for the monitoring and the advocacy. One of the inherent things for physician health programs, and this is a little scary sometimes for the general public, is that you can be anonymous in a PHP in most states, meaning if the medical board doesn't already know about you, if you haven't gotten a DWI or something like that, and haven't broken the law, you can come into the PHP anonymously and get help early. And again, that's really a bedrock cornerstone of a physician's health program, is to get the doctor in early. Most PHPs cover addiction and usually other mental health issues. Some cover behavioral issues, you know, the classic, I'm going to pick on surgeons a little bit, you know, the surgeon who throws the scalpel or makes fun of colleagues. I used to joke to some of the hospitals, well, we'll take a behavioral referral from you, hospital XYZ, but you have to send us 5 alcoholics first. That tells you how easy the behavioral folks are to work with. Some states work with that and some don't. So why do we have PHPs? What's the idea behind that? What's the reason? Well, I've talked a little bit about it in the abstract. The concrete is that we have a 70 to 90% success rate across the country at 5 years. 70 to 90% success rate at 5 years. That compares with a really good treatment center. It's hard to even get 5-year outcome data. But comparable data probably is in the arena of 30% at 1 year for a really good treatment center. So PHPs really have a very good track record. Confidentiality is crucial, and I've talked about this a little bit. Some of you, many, probably everybody in this room has heard about the Germanwings tragedy, the case where the pilot flew the plane into the mountain in Europe intentionally and turned out to have mental health issues. Some of the press you heard about that afterwards was, well, it's real simple. We just need to make sure that all pilots reveal all their mental health records, and that'll be taken care of. Well, it turns out if you do that, nobody's going to get help. And instead of, you know, maybe one crash a year or one every 10 years, you're going to have a lot more than that, because pilots or by association doctors are going to have a lot more problems. So you really want doctors to be able to get help confidentially. I will say, and it's historically most PHPs have been based on AA, and that's the model I kind of grew up with professionally. It's the model I know. It's the model I believe in. AA is, as Mike Wilkerson, somebody I used to work with, used to say, AA is not the only way to the top of the mountain, and that's kind of heresy to say in this room, but I firmly believe there's a lot of different ways to get sober. My personal belief is AA is the best, and it turns out there's a lot of free Sherpas in AA. There's a lot of help. There's a lot of meetings that you won't find readily available, you know, in other recovery movements. And we do continue to use AA quite a bit. So how are doctors the same, and how are doctors different from other folks that are trying to be recovery, get into recovery? So doctors are used to being told or feeling like we're the smartest guy in the room. So, you know, since Enron, that's not necessarily the best thing to be, the smartest guy or gal in the room. And it turns out, as Dr. Johnson was saying, you know, that's also my experience. I've never met anybody too stupid to be in recovery. I've met a lot of people who are too smart to be in recovery, too smart for their own good. And that's sort of where doctors live. It's not necessarily an advantage. Doctors are used to overthinking things. We're kind of paid to overthink things. We're paid to be kind of OCD to a certain extent. It's a professional advantage when you try and take it into your personal life, and especially if you're trying to get into recovery, it can really be an impediment. Doctors, it turns out, surprise, surprise, don't like to be the patient. I mean, number one, who really does want to be the patient? You know, it's a lot more fun to wear the white coat than the backless gown. But it's really hard to metaphorically and physically take off that white coat and wear the patient robe, you know, be the patient. It's a professional identity issue, and this is why we find in professional health programs that we often need to refer to specialty programs that cater to professionals and really don't care. They care that you have MD or DO or RN or whatever after your name, but they really don't care. They're going to help you take off that white coat. Paul Early talked about that in the chapter, the ASAM criteria, the latest edition of the criteria book, where he talks about safety-sensitive professionals. Goes into a lot of details in that. Doctors don't like to be addicts or alcoholics. Again, who grew up thinking, yeah, I'm going to be in the rooms of AA. That's on my bucket list. But doctors in particular, we get trained and we see people come through. We see the revolving door patient through the ER. And that's kind of our mental image almost of the addict and alcoholic. It's not the white collar person. And so it makes it doubly hard when we have a problem ourselves to think, I'm a white collar guy. I'm just like everybody else, in recovery. Hard to do that. High functioning alcoholic often doesn't compute. So often doctors don't like to go to AA or other recovery meetings. I've heard any number of times, you know, I can't, Dr. Pendergast, I understand you want me to go to those meetings, but what if I see one of my patients? Well, you know, it turns out if you see one of your patients, they're probably there for the same reason you are. Secondly, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember one case in particular where that came up, and the partner of the doctor who had referred him said, yeah, he's probably going to say that he didn't want to go to meetings. And it turned out this partner who referred, I'll call him Fred, referred Fred to us, was himself in recovery. But you tell Fred, he's the only person in Granville County that doesn't know he's an alcoholic. And in fact, that was true. Fred did go to meetings in Granville County. It's not really Granville County, but he went to meetings in his county, and they basically said, you know, we've been waiting for you to come in. I'm glad you're here. We do find if we can get doctors into meetings, they often catch the disease, and that happens very often. We had doctors, a lot of doctors, and it turns out we do have doctors-only meetings. Many of you may be familiar with caduceus. Some caduceus meetings throughout the country are on very much on the AA model, some are not, but they do exist. Some doctors have trouble with the disease model. They'll give it lip service. I mean, for God's sake, the AMA endorsed alcoholism as a disease as far back as 1956. But a lot of doctors will give it lip service but not really believe it. They still see it as a moral failing or a weakness. Maybe not in others, but if it's them, it's a moral failing or a weakness. And I can tell you that from long experience. A lot of times doctors, and our education about addiction in medical school is still not that great. It's a lot better than it used to be 20, 30, 40 years ago, but it's still not that great. A lot of doctors think they know more about addiction than they do. I remember one surgeon sitting across from me, and he was referring, he said, psychiatry, you know, no offense, but how hard can that be? You know, you guys just sit around and talk to people all day. And he meant both psychiatry and addictionology. I mean, how hard can that be as compared to surgery? The other thing about doctors is they think it's okay to go to work sick. They exhibit, Americans I think are susceptible to this in general, but doctors even more so. They do what's called presenteeism, opposite of absenteeism. They go to work when they're sick and they shouldn't go to work. And so they can get pretty far down that curve of the disease before they stop going to work. They may have more trouble with AA in particular. We found in North Carolina, I think nationally, AA seems to be on a roll these days of getting some bad press. I don't know if any of you have read that. The recent Gabriel Glasser article in The Atlantic, you know, kind of AA bashing. And the docs that really don't want to get in recovery seem to have all read that by the time they come to see us. I find in general, and particularly with the doctors that I've worked with over the last 16 years, most people's trouble, I think, with AA is really about that pesky first step, you know, the one where you can't drink. It's really, and I also find that, you know, as hard as the idea of powerlessness is, I think for many of us, unmanageability is even harder than powerlessness. And doctors, you know, they tend to think, well, I got through residency, I got through medical school, my life isn't unmanageable. I got the big house, you know, I'm on my third wife, but, you know, that's still manageable. You know, how hard can this alcoholism be? I'll just stop drinking if you insist on it. I think there's also a lot of us in the medical field who struggle with religion and spirituality, and again, kind of often, I think, use that as an excuse to avoid AA. Doug Talbot, who I referred to earlier, coined the phrase the MDAA syndrome, and I think the MDAA syndrome is really something that a lot of us buy into. Doctors, in fact, are the same as everybody else, and Dr. Johnson did a great job of talking about the neurophysiology of addiction, the neocortex and the paleocortex, the new brain, the alligator brain. My experience has been that doctors often have more trouble believing in the alligator brain because they have really overdeveloped the frontal prefrontal cortex, that executive function. They fool themselves into believing it's more in charge than it really is in general, and especially long after the alligator brain has hijacked the rest. Doctors still think this part is in charge, and they have a lot of trouble with that. They have the same issues with shame as everybody else. They still have to hit a personal bottom, and no, I'm not talking about sex addiction here, but that could apply. It doesn't have to be rock bottom, and I think, you know, the upside and the downside for physicians, we get more scrutiny, we're held to a higher standard and probably should be. Often we can get in recovery earlier as a result. Doctors are the same too. My experience before I got into physicians' health work, most of us just don't wake up on Tuesday and say, you know, I think it's a good idea, I'll go to a meeting. They usually have to have some consequences, and doctors are the same as that with everybody else. Let me talk a little bit about female physicians, partly because I think the addiction field hasn't focused on female addiction maybe as well as it should, and in particular, I think the physician health field needs to do a better job of helping women physicians and PAs recover. Medical school graduates are now more than 50% of the graduating class in the United States. Our physician population is going to be increasingly female. The culture of medicine is still largely male, though, I think, and the culture of recovery still is. The suicide rate for male physicians is higher than the general population. It's about 1.4 times higher than the general population for males. It's an astounding, staggering, shocking 2.25 times higher for female physicians. Female physicians are 2.25 times as likely to suicide as the general population. A lot of that has to do with addiction. Female physicians are as susceptible to the good old 13th step as everybody else in recovery. So let me talk briefly, and I'm kind of running out of time here, but let me talk briefly about how to approach a doctor at a meeting. And the first piece of advice I give you, if you're not in healthcare, is don't approach them at a meeting. At least as a doctor. Don't not approach them. Don't isolate them, but don't approach them as a doctor. You need to help them understand. They need to understand themselves. They're just another bozo on the bus. They really are. They happen to have MD after their name or RN or whatever it might be, but that doesn't give them any special power over alcohol. The reasons you don't want to do that is you're going to really make it harder if you approach them and say, hey, doc, I need some free medical advice. You know, you're going to make it harder for them to stay in touch with their own unmanageability. You will be making them as a healthcare professional, you might be making them your own HP, and you don't want to do that. And you also might be endangering their license if they wind up giving you free medical advice or God forbid, a prescription. The traditions address this. Tradition 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. We're not here in meetings for free medical advice, and that's important to remember. Number 8, Tradition 8 is especially on point with this. Alcoholics Anonymous shall remain forever non-professional. Take off your work hat. If you're in a meeting, take off your work hat and help the doctor, or make it easy for the doctor to do the same thing. And then 12, and I'll use the long form here, the principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we are actually to practice a genuine humility. We're all equals. We're all equals in the rooms, and that's critically important for physicians. So I'm going to close with a couple quotes. Ernie Kurst said, whenever, wherever, one alcoholic meets another alcoholic and sees in that person first and foremost, not that he or she is male or female, or black or white, or Christian, Buddhist, Jew, or atheist, or gay or straight, or whatever, but sees that he or she is alcoholic, and that therefore both of them need each other, there will not only be an Alcoholics Anonymous, but there will be the Alcoholics Anonymous that you and I love so much and respect so deeply. And finally, I'll close. Ernie actually himself, Dr. Kurtz, said that spirituality can't be defined, but it can be described. And one of the best descriptions I heard of spirituality came from my friend Mick O, who said, spirituality is what lives in the space between people. So I'll close with that and say thank you. I am indeed privileged, honored, and grateful to have shared this space with you.